From the Sky News Centre at 6, a gun battle's underway in Sri Lanka between government soldiers and suspects in the Easter Sunday bomb attacks. The shootout's ongoing in a town around 200 miles east of the capital, Colombo. Authorities say they found a bomb factory there. Our Foreign Affairs editor, Deborah Haynes, has been looking at footage emerging from inside.
There is equipment there, such as explosive charges, and also, significantly, it looks as though the security forces found the black flag of Islamic State.
The British and Irish governments have called for new thinking as they announced new talks aimed at re-establishing power sharing in Northern Ireland. The murder of journalist Leader McKee by the new IRAs put pressure on politicians. Ireland's Foreign Affairs Minister Simon Coveney says there's an urgent need for determined action.
2 years and counting, without an assembly, without an executive, and without a North-South ministerial council. We are leaving far too much wide open space for other kinds of voices.
Plans by Debenhams' new owners to close 22 stores next year could put 1,200 jobs at risk. Creditors will have to agree to the turnaround plan. Jeremy Corbyn's been joined in declining an invite to a state dinner with Donald Trump by the Speaker of the House of Commons, John Bercow. They're both refusing to go to Buckingham Palace when the President visits in June. Senior government ministers have reportedly been given an ultimatum over the leak of details from a secret security meeting about Chinese firm Huawei. The former chair of the Intelligence and Security Committee, Sir Malcolm Rifkind, says it's a serious situation.
The particular problem here is it's the National Security Council, and the National Security Council, consisting of senior cabinet ministers, heads of the intelligence agencies and several others, have access to top-secret classified information.
And Uber's hoping to be valued at £70 billion when it's floated on the New York Stock Exchange. The figures emerge from company documents. That's the latest. I'm David Marsland.
On BCFM 93.2...
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Labour councillor for Lockleaze, Estella Ticknell. So, ex-Sunday Times rich list journalist and author of Who Owns Britain and Who Owns the World, Kevin Cahill. Also, Labour Party Oxford economist and Irish Republican Martis Summers is here too. After the 7 o'clock news, happy Easter everybody. With Notre Dame burning down and 350 Sri Lankan churchgoers, 45 of them children, massacred on Easter Sunday. No cause here really, just pure evil. Anyone could think that there was no God. Or was the whole idea, like previous attacks on Egyptian churches, etc., to seed into religious hatred? We hear some commentators saying that's what it was about. India warned Sri Lanka the church bombers were coming, but Defence Minister and Police Chief didn't pass the warning on to the people who needed to know in Sri Lanka. Government Minister Harin Fernando apparently warned his son not to go to church that morning. But what of wider accusations from Israeli-backed site intelligence and others that ISIS were behind the attack? Speculation that it was a retribution for Christchurch. Well, Israelis Pamela Geller and Rita Katz seem to know everything about the attacks almost immediately. So how do they know so much and steer the news agenda? Are they the world's best intelligence service, or were they the perpetrators? How does killing children help your cause? Why would a suicide bomber attack a soft target when it's easy to just put down a bag, walk off and detonate it round the corner? Did they know their rucksacks contained bombs? Were the bombs pre-planted? So many questions not asked by our journalists as peaceful New Zealand and now Sri Lanka too are dragged into the global war on terror. Also, journalist Lyra McKee shot in Derry Maundy Thursday. But why were PSNI doing a sectarian fishing operation provoking the riots that killed her? Why haven't top cops resigned? That's all in the second hour after the US-owned Comcast News at 7. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight lows around 7, light rain and some strong winds. This weekend, highs around 11 Celsius, rain and strong winds tomorrow morning, light rain and moderate breeze though on Sunday. So next week, highs up to 16 Celsius, light cloud and a bit breezy. Next weekend, that's the 4th and 5th of May, highs around 14 Celsius with sunny spells. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So joining me to review this week's news is Labour Councillor for Lockleys, Estella Ticknell. Hi, Estella. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello. Thank you.
Could you just remind us about your day job? Because you're up at one of the universities, aren't
you? Yes, I teach at U. I teach film studies.
I remember very well last time you were here talking about...
Some people.
Talking Pictures.
Yes. Oh, I've been watching Talking Pictures today,
and
yes.
You know what? Since you told us about that, we've been watching it quite a lot too.
And what's your verdict on it?
Very, very good, actually.
It is,
and
yeah.
I think if you compare the stuff that's on at the cinemas now to what you can get for free on Freeview, the Talking Pictures...
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I think you'd be mad to go to the picture.
I agree.
Why is that? But why is... Okay, so why is the slide... I mean, I was listening to Mark Commode on Five Live film review at lunchtime, and so many of the films, they're saying, well, this is just awful, this film.
Well, don't forget that Talking Pictures makes a selection of films. It won't always show the dross. Now, in any week, then there'll be a number of releases, some of which will be brilliant or some which will be dreadful. I mean, for example, earlier this week, I went to see Wild Rose, which is a fantastic British film about a young Glaswegian woman with a wonderful voice who wants to be a country and western star. And it's a really fabulous film, in the best tradition of British filmmaking, actually. Kind of social realism, but it's also got an edge of comedy in it. Julie Walters is fabulous as her mother. But of course, in any given week, there will be good films and bad films. And Talking Pictures is good in that, you know, sometimes you do get some ropey stuff, but you often get some really good ones.
One of my all-time favourites is The Life of Brian.
And
I was quite shocked to hear that nearly never got made.
It nearly never got made because EMI pulled out. Yes. And of course we know who rescued Life of Brian, don't we? George Harrison. Yes.
Isn't it incredible that some of the best films ever made nearly didn't go? What is going on in the film industry? Why do the financiers not back sometimes the very best in filmmaking, in the script writers?
Well,
what's going on?
That's a really good question. I mean, to be honest, even the biggest Hollywood conglomerates cannot always predict when something's going to work. You know, it's an art, not a science, knowing. And the amount of finance that you actually have to put in, that is why there are so many franchises around now. So Marvel is onto a good thing. Because what you do is you secure your audience by offering them more of the same, but something different. So you end up with a kind of, you know, multivarious versions of the same kind of story. In action movies have always been successful and popular. And once you've got a franchise going, you've basically got a kind of, you know, an audience ready and waiting there. And that's one of the reasons why franchises are kind of taking over mainstream cinema.
Okay, so it sounds a bit formulaic and like a bit like politics, the best of a bad bunch, isn't it?
I don't think politics is very formulaic at the moment, do you?
I'm saying the best of a bad bunch. I mean, looking, for example, at the US elections and the visit of Donald Trump just coming up.
You do wonder if
Donald Trump really is the best person to run America.
Well, he clearly isn't.
So why are we getting...
I'm not wondering about that at all.
So Theresa May, probably you would say, being a Labour Party person, is not the best person to run Britain.
No.
I think it'd be lots and lots of people who agree with you. And
yes.
Also, in fact, a lot of Conservatives.
In fact, most of them are the Conservative Party, yeah.
So why are we getting such a bad deal? Let's get off the films now, in politics.
Well, actually, I think one problem is, at the moment, with Brexit, we're in a kind of stalemate, aren't we? And it's very, very difficult to come up with solution to it, given that the majority of people who voted fractionally in favour of Brexit, but we actually have a very vocal minority who actually don't want us to leave the EU at all. I think that, to be fair to Theresa May, any Prime Minister would struggle to reconcile the kind of problems that she has had to do. Now, she's handled it extremely badly. That's partly down to her personality. She's someone who doesn't really share very openly. She's very controlling, very stubborn. We know that because she's brought the same deal back to the table, what is it, 3 or 4 times now. But at the same time, of course, she's got a very noisy and increasingly hostile group within her party who have been pushing her further and further rightward with the kind of nonsense we've been hearing about a no-deal exit, which I heard today is going to... I mean, even, you know, even Conservatives like Philip Hammond are warning that it could push the country into a 50-year recession without a deal. I mean, this is... We were promised the earth by the Brexiteers.
We were told,
you know,
all this stuff about disaster happening.
Exactly, and now we're going to go out and catch rabbits.
Hang on, we were told about that when the vote happened, weren't we?
Well, some of us heard that.
If you dare to vote vote for Brexit, the markets are going to collapse.
I can remember knocking on a door in Lotley's, actually, and saying exactly that. And I'm afraid I was sent away with a flea in my ear, you know. And I said, you won't be able to go on holiday. So I don't care. I don't want to go on holiday.
Anyway, while we're talking about Theresa May, I think one of the greatest stories this week, and Kevin Carhill's joining us, I'm sure he'll have something to say about this, is this terrible leak. There's now going to have to be
terrible leak.
MI5 investigation, the special branch, or just about all the police in London are hounding now to try and find who it was that dared to tell the Daily Telegraph that we were overruling the Americans.
I heard Max Hastings on PM earlier on, just before I left, and he was giving very strong hints that he knew who it was. He said it very, very clearly. It was he, and he said most people know who it is, including the civil service. Of course, he wasn't saying who it was, so that narrows it down, doesn't it?
But so whoever it was should be obviously put in the Tower of London.
Probably. Except, I think one thing that's really interesting about this is it's clearly a breakdown of cabinet responsibility.
Should it be that secret? I mean, the idea that we are going to actually start using not going to stop using Chinese equipment. Surely the real thing is embarrassment. We don't like to be seen to be doing anything that Donald Trump doesn't like.
Well,
the Americans don't like.
Good point, yeah.
Isn't that really what it's about?
But I think that, I don't think that's a reason. But I do, I mean, clearly there is a kind of legal issue about, you know, the fact that that particular committee is a highly secret committee. The larger issue for me about Huawei and the possibility of 5G is that given Brexit, if we really do leave, we are going to have to start trading with these people. You know, we're going to have to start cutting deals with the Chinese. And I don't want us to be pushed by Trump. I think it's very important. We don't simply jump when Trump says, you know. But it's something we're going to have to start talking about.
The thing is, all these government committees do strategic leaks all the time, don't they? It's just when something comes out they didn't want to. Isn't that really what it's about? Anyway, look, I'll tell you what, we'll go to the House of Commons on Wednesday where this whole Huawei issue came up.
Dr. Julian Lewis. The government accept that the telecommunications firm Huawei is intimately linked with the Chinese Communist government and its deeply hostile intelligence services.
Minister. Well, I mean, legally speaking, it is a private firm, not a government-owned company. But my right honourable friend takes us to the question about the proposed rollout of 5G networks. The Department for Digital, Culture, Media and Sport has commissioned a very wide-ranging, thorough review of this. We are giving priority to stronger cybersecurity practices across the entire telecommunications sector, greater resilience in telecommunications networks, and critically, diversity in the entire supply chain for 5G, because this question goes beyond any single company. When we've taken decisions about that review, we will announce them to the House in the proper way.
Now, that wasn't Theresa May, you may have noticed, Kevin. I think it's David Lidington standing in for her. And Emily Thornberry, I think, was standing in for Jeremy Corbyn this week. But anyway, what do you make of this threat from the Chinese intelligence services and Huawei, Kevin?
Well, put it really simply, and we've often put it in those terms here, the United States has mass and indiscriminate surveillance running on 67% of the United Kingdom. How could China be worse?
So, surely the United States are our allies, they're our friends, they're using that intelligence for good means. Surely the Chinese, they're a hostile power, isn't that what they're saying?
The Chinese haven't got the ability to do the mass surveillance the United States is doing. The United States uses the internet companies to steal, intercept emails, steal data, and it covers 67% of the UK.
Well, some people are saying that the Android system, which is on most smartphones nowadays, is actually designed to just take your data and feed it to the National Security Agency in the US.
October 2018, Sir Nigel Shadbolt, 90% of all mobile data apps feed the data straight to the United States. There seems to be nothing in between.
Martin, is it okay, do you think, to treat the Chinese like we would, say, treat the Americans? Say, well, it's actually okay for you to have a bit of our data so long as our 5G systems, mobile systems work?
Well, what you're bringing up is the tension between so-called free market economics and geopolitics. And the reality is that the two things are totally mixed together, aren't they? And of course, ultimately, the Chinese are the rising power in the world economy. And if, for example, we do have Brexit, as Estrella is suggesting, we've got to do deals with them. And therefore, that side of the cabinet is saying, well, you know, there's no point being silly about this. If they're the cheapest and they're the best, then we've got to go with them.
Now, what about making a big fuss about the leak to the Telegraph?
Well, this is more to do with the internal struggle in the Tory party, because they're basically jockeying for position, and you've got a pro-Atlanticist lot, you know, Liam Fox and all these others who don't want to, they want to keep him with Trump, and Trump's basically said, don't touch, I wait. Well, they've arrested that woman who's the chief executive, and they're going to send her to prison in the US. The Chinese are going bonkers because she's just, you know, she's their version of Richard Branson.
What the Chinese,
you know,
have done is they've arrested a bunch of Canadians instead, haven't they?
This is what they did, the Americans, 40 years ago. I wrote the book. Paddy Ashdown spoke it in Parliament. The Americans bounced us out of the computer industry completely 30 years ago. We don't make computers. We don't make anything. So we have to buy it. Martin's partly right. We have to buy it somewhere. But the difference between buying it from the Chinese at the moment is they don't have the mass surveillance on our population that the United States does.
Well, there's a few ex-aero engineers up at Filton or from Filton who probably worked on Concorde who would also say actually the computers weren't the only industry that the Americans bounced us out of. Ultimately, though, I think we should come back to look at Brexit, because we're in this sort of long interregnum now. The idea was we were supposed to leave, but we didn't leave. Some people say legally we should have left. And now we've got UK Independence Party, which has veered to the far right with Gerald Batten as the leader. In fact, we had, I think, Ben Walker, who's on their national executive from Bradley Stoke, in here a few months ago, saying he was going to hang on as long as he, in UKIP, as long as he could see there was some possibility of stopping it being a racist party. But it now is, pretty much. And so there's been a launch for the European elections. And I suppose this is the question tonight, isn't it? Right, are we going to be having European elections? So let's have a listen to, well, certainly Nigel Farage is prepared for them, and his new Brexit party. And his main target, he says, for this new Brexit party, which is replacing UKIP, is Labour.
We've seen the party that stood again in 2017 promising to implement the result of the referendum, almost in slow motion, piece by piece, they've now virtually become a Remainer party. I mean, why else would you put Lord Adonis on your MEP list in the southwest of England? Now, Lord Adonis, I think, has been very helpful, because he said, if you're a Brexiteer, don't vote Labour. And I want, as leader of the Brexit party, to absolutely echo what Lord Adonis has said, and I intend to do that quite a lot over the course of the next few weeks. I will, as leader of the party, be spending most of my time in South Wales, in the Midlands, and in the north of England, in predominantly Labour areas. You see, 61% of Labour MPs represent Brexit constituencies. Of the 25 most marginal seats that the Labour Party holds, 20 of them are Leave constituencies. Of the 45 seats in England and Wales that Labour absolutely have to win to form a majority, 40 of them are Brexit constituencies. There are 5 million people out there that voted for Jeremy Corbyn, that voted for Brexit as well. And that's going to be our task.
So the Brexit Party, Estella, says that it's got Labour in its sights because they believe Labour are most vulnerable simply because they're not implementing the decision to leave the EU.
Well, clearly, within Labour, as in within the Tory party too, there have been conflicting views on Brexit. But I think what's clear is increasingly Labour voters are having the scales fall from their eyes on the Brexit promises and seeing how shallow they were. And I would, certainly in the European elections, I would urge anyone who supports Remain to vote Labour. I mean, that's going to be your only option, it seems to me.
Well, and the Lib Dems won't say that, will they? And neither will this other Change UK.
The Lib Dems are struggling. Vince Cable is not a particularly effective leader, in my
view. He's about to leave as well.
Yeah, he's about to leave. It's not, you know, I mean, And I'm extremely concerned too by the way in which the route that UKIP has taken, and with people like Stephen Yaxley-Lennon, you know, moving into the you know, with effectively neo-fascist politics. I mean, it's terrifying what's happening.
Well, maybe next week we'll have a clip from their launch as well, because it was.
Like, I think that's vital.
Basically, a bunch of thugs.
Yes, they are a bunch of thugs.
And
yeah.
saying some really horrific things, abusive things about women, that sort of thing.
But it's it's normalising misogyny. It's normalising racism. It's normalising hate. In ways that I find absolutely terrifying.
It's incredible what's happened to UKIP, really. Anyway, so the Brexit Party's sort of taking over. But on the other side, on the Remain side, as well as, of course, as Estella's pointing out there, the Labour Party as a Remain party, what about the Change UK? And so here is their launch for the European elections with their spokesman, Chuka Amuna.
The governing Conservative Party have adopted the Farage agenda pretty much wholesale since 2016, which is why they and our politics is in such a mess. The Labour Party sits on the fence and refuses to properly take Farage on. It is led by a lifelong Brexiter who would rather press on with this Brexit disaster, of which Farage was the architect, than argue for a different course and unequivocally back a people's vote. We, on the other hand, reject the politics of Farage. He doesn't speak for our nation, and we will say so loudly every single day of this campaign.
Kevin, what do you make of Change UK? This is the new party, which is a form of split, people who split off from Labour, and Anna Soubry from the Conservatives.
Well, one of the problems you've got is that Farage is very charismatic, and the Change Party look stale, middle-class and middle-aged. And some of them aren't even middle-aged. They're pitching to young people. They're not getting there at all. They're missing the...
One of the problems is they don't seem to have a lot of grassroots support. Martin, a lot of the Conservatives' grassroots are simply saying, well, we're not even going to bother campaigning for the Conservatives. We're off to campaign for the Brexit Party.
Yeah, well, I think that's the way the cookie will crumble, isn't it? The Tory Party are going to be marmalised, as Andrew Rawnsley pointed out in the Observer, and that's why they're terrified of these elections. A lot of the Tory right will vote for Farage.
So why is Theresa May even contemplating having these elections?
She's had to, because it's force majeure. It's force majeure. The other 27 countries, including Ireland, which we may come to, have basically forced her hand. And yet the Irish backstop, as everybody's talking about, is fundamental. And they're basically saying you can have a no-deal Brexit, but you've got to give us a united Ireland, which is the quid pro quo. And of course they can't do that because the DUP won't have it.
Also, on Question Time last night, we had Caroline Lucas explaining why she believes that actually even the new party Farage is in is racist.
At the last general election, around 68% of all votes cast didn't actually count for anything because they stacked up in constituencies where there already enough votes had been...
She's making a point about PR here too.
...over the line. So I think one thing we should be doing is getting a voting system whereby everyone's vote really counts. Now, on the big issue, the question that you actually asked, how much should we be worried about these two parties? Well, I am worried about Nigel Farage because he's very good at whipping up a lot of hatred and racism, and I'm very worried about that.
Well, not necessarily a very positive reaction from the audience. Do you think she's over-egging the pudding there, Estella, maybe, saying that he's racist?
No, I think he is closet racist, actually. But just to come back to the Change UK party, I'm old enough to remember the SDP, which actually has some titans of the Labour Party. You know, the people who've been cabinet members, you know, cabinet ministers, and ultimately the SDP failed in its kind of project. Now, it seems to me that Change UK is a distraction, I'm sorry to say. They don't have particularly significant politicians, it's a one-issue party, and they are not getting traction, especially not amongst young people.
Also on Question Time, we had a chap called John Russenden, who was the only Brexiteer on the panel, which does seem a bit biased, particularly since Nottingham itself is I think voted pro-Brexit, but last night there was only one. And the BBC seems to be doing this quite a lot. You need to be, I think, a little bit more careful, BBC, about getting a balance of Brexit and Remain on your panels, please. And here is the actor John Russenden talking about, well, he's comparing the potential, if there is no Brexit deal, to what he saw in Yugoslavia. And we'll hear from Martin, because Martin was over in Yugoslavia too, is what he makes of that.
I was in... Before, during, and after the civil war in Yugoslavia, I've seen civil war, and You know, we all have, every country has fragmentary impulses. We have to hold things together one way or the other to keep the Scots in line, the Welsh in line, the English in line, the Irish in line. And it's a united kingdom. If you start unpicking, if you start saying, this is not fit for purpose, I warn you, you sow the wind, you will reap the whirlwind. And that is the most frightening thing that this betrayal of Brexit is going to do.
Hi, I agree with everything that you just said. I'm a Leaver. Very proud to be a Leaver, entirely frustrated with the government, and I think you guys need to be seriously concerned, not just about the European elections, the local elections, the general elections, the whole lot. People have had enough. We've got a court case. My question didn't get on the panel tonight, but legally, we've already left the EU. There is a court case going on right now, and obviously the government have responded to this. But it seems to be completely ignored. The public are being completely ignored, whether you are a Leaver, whether you are a Remainer. People are fed up with the government and the entire democratic system at the moment, and the shambles that is going on in the parliament. We are fed up to it.
Fed up with it, Martin. But anyway, the main point there he was making was about the potential for this to really get out of control if the Brexit vote is just ignored by Parliament.
Well, I think there's a potential for it to get out of control because of the situation which is objectively there. If you look at what's happened in former Yugoslavia, you've got several republics which are now part of the EU, like Croatia and Slovenia. Kosovo is still not part of the EU because it's not been recognised as a state. Bosnia is still a failed state. And, of course, the whole thing of extending the European Union into Yugoslavia, the Tories basically agreed with the Germans that they would recognise Croatia as an independent state on the basis that we would be opting out of the Maastricht Treaty.
This isn't the point they're making. The point they're making was to do with whether Parliament is actually going to be the servant of the people and do what the people voted for or not.
Well, the question is this a United Kingdom? Just as whether, is it Yugoslavia or a former Yugoslavia? And of course, in Ireland, we've had a civil war in this country, not in Yugoslavia, Tony.
In 2014, the Scots decided to have a referendum and they decided to stay with the United Kingdom.
Yes, but as you will also know, sir, that Nicola Sturgeon said the other day, if Brexit goes through, they're going to have another go.
And she'll probably lose.
Will she? And the other thing, of course, is the Irish backstop, which we've all been talking about. You can't leave the EU unless you let the six counties voted to remain in the EU. And, of course, we've had the shooting in Derry last week, which possibly we will come to in a moment. And the whole idea that civil wars happen in other countries, but they don't happen here, just wrong. We've already had one, and it could get worse. And it's not just about Brexit. It's about English nationalism and silly attitudes all round, isn't it?
Okay, so
we invade Iraq, we invade Afghanistan, that's all good, isn't it?
That's not good, no. And it's not going to cause a civil war, is it? What is likely to cause a civil war is if Parliament actually doesn't reflect the views of the people. And that's what the point he was trying to make, and he made it again.
Don't denigrate the intelligence of the British voting public. You put 10 things in your manifesto, if we get 3 of them through, we'll settle for that. Brexit was the biggest choice of a generation, the most important choice if we are to have an economic future. And we voted for it. And you guys will damage democracy and are damaging democracy if you don't deliver it.
You can keep ignoring it.
No, there's two things. Everybody is saying Parliament is divided, but the country is divided. And you have to look somewhere else for a solution
country,
in that situation.
The country has voted and
no, wait. Some of the country, that's, you know, whether you leave or remain, some of the country voted to leave and a lot didn't. You've got a divided nation and you've got a divided Parliament. That's the catch. And clearly, why do you expect the Remainers to accept 4% as the margin? The referendum was badly structured.
Mr. David Tredinnick.
Mr. Speaker, may I associate myself with remarks made about Sri Lanka? My right honourable friend, tell us whether he thinks it likely we'll leave the European Union by May the 22nd. And does he agree with me that both the major political parties are likely to suffer at the polls if we don't? And what does it say to my Leicestershire constituents about the democratic process if this House can't get this withdrawal agreement to leave the European Union over the line?
Yeah.
Speaker, I completely understand and share that sense of exasperation that my honourable friend has expressed. I mean, it has been made very clear from this dispatch box on several occasions that the consequence of the House voting to reject the withdrawal agreement and to vote in favour of an extension is that the government would need to make preparations as required by law for those European elections. The way in which we solve this problem is for Parliament to assemble a majority behind a deal, vote for it, get the legislation through and give effect to our departure from the EU.
Martin, May the 22nd is the latest deadline. Is anything going to happen by then or not?
Well, I think we're going to have a European election. That's pretty clear what's going to happen. And that will be, in effect, if you count the votes up, it'll be a referendum by default. And people who will see where things lie. Can I point out that the Welsh Assembly has already come out clearly in favour of a second referendum? Because opinion in Wales has shifted. So you've got a situation where England, Wales and Ireland, Wales, Ireland and Scotland all voted to stay in the EU. England voted to leave. But of course, if we get a united Ireland, all the Brexit votes in Northern Ireland, you have to take them out. Sinn Féin could take their seats. They don't. But if they did, we wouldn't be talking about this because we'd already have knocked it on the head. And that's the civil war underlying the whole thing. It's been going on since 1916,
and
Tony. It's not about Yugoslavia.
The possibility is that we might actually leave the EU. And if we do...
If you're an EU citizen living in the UK, you will need to apply to the EU Settlement Scheme. The scheme is fully open and you have plenty of time to apply. It is free and all you need is your passport or ID card and to complete an online form. Support is available if you have any questions. To find out more and to apply, visit gov.uk/EU Settlement Scheme. Irish citizens or those with valid indefinite leave don't need to apply.
Well, that's enough for Brexit for the time being. Lots of other things have been going on. One of the most fascinating, I think, over the last week or so is this Extinction Rebellion protest in London. Estella, do you want to start us off on that? What do you make of it? Do you think there's the Extinction Rebellion protests in London?
Yes. What
do you make of all of that? Do you think they're actually achieving much?
Well, they've certainly have achieved something, haven't they, insofar as they've made people talk about it. And I think that's a very good thing, actually, because undoubtedly, while we've been preoccupied with Brexit, we've lost sight of all the other major issues which we're facing, and climate change is clearly the big one. You know, it's not much point worrying about Brexit if we're having significant changes to our climate, which we're already noticing, and the long-term consequences of which we can't easily predict. So, for example, one consequence of climate change is migration crisis that we're encountering. So many of the migrants who are attempting to get to Europe are coming from parts of Africa and Asia where climate change is already having a serious impact on their livelihoods. Their solution is to leave and try to find somewhere else to make a living. And that's having a significant impact. It's never talked about when we talk about the migration crisis.
Quite a lot of these migrants come from war zones, don't they? We've seen the same in the US, you know, in Central America. It's often where the US is making mess, sending mercenaries in God knows what.
Sure.
Messing with the politics of countries and, of course, the IMF. You know, economically messing.
But fighting over scarce resources is often one of the motivations for that kind of conflict. That's the problem. And it seems to me that this is clearly the major issue. Now, whether we approve of the particular techniques taken by the Extinction Rebellion group, I'm not sure. I heard today that someone had actually glued her breast to the pavement, which sounds so painful and a bit pointless to me. But nonetheless, you know, they're getting us talking about it and getting us thinking about it.
What about Martin or Kevin on this? What about this whole thing of picketing Jeremy Corbyn's house? Because he's very pro doing something about climate change. And also sellotaping. No, actually, again, it's glue, isn't it? Gluing yourself to the Docklands Light Railway.
Well, interestingly enough, and I hate to put a cat among the pigeons here, his brother Piers Corbyn, who you know, Tony, is a leading climate change sceptic, and he doesn't believe in climate change. He's a scientist.
Pick it Piers Corbyn's house rather than Jeremy Corbyn.
Well, there you go.
Corbyn then, or what?
He's bad as a
hatter. Well, I don't know what I think. I'm just saying that's just information for the audience.
Okay, Kevin, what about the Docklands Light Railway? Do we need to close that down to make our point about climate change?
What they did, I think, was very valuable, as Stella says. It got people talking about something really serious. But I wonder, I mean, do you remember Occupy? Is this not just a repeat? of, do you remember Occupy? And it was all about the big thing, and then they've disappeared without a trace.
They are still around, Occupy. They still do meetings. They don't do occupations. But
well, in actual fact, the All Hallows Hall down here is a community hall, which was built, which was squatted during that era, and is still functioning as a community facility. So there was a follow-on. But if, interestingly enough, Occupy were driven off Parliament Square, and you remember, you know, the peace protesters were, but the climate change protesters have been somewhat more indulged because I think they've got bigger protectors.
Well, it's a Bristol based movement, Extinction Rebellion. It started here with something called Rising Up a few years ago, and it's now picking up in all other parts of the world as well. I feel almost proud that we're starting this sort of thing. But one of the original co-founders of Extinction Rebellion, and I haven't seen an interview, I mean, it would be interesting to see him on Question Time. His name is Roger Hallam. This is one of the reasons he says that he started it all.
I'm just like reinventing standard classical non-violence theory from the late 20th century, you know, from 1930 through to, you know, the late 80s. There was a whole load of big political struggles in the 20th century that were based upon really solid ideas about how power works. And how power works is that if you challenge it, it's in a dilemma, because it's either going to repress you or it's going to retreat. Because it knows if it represses you, then you get this backfiring effect, or you risk it, which is you bring more people into the field. So, you know, what's been really interesting for the last 2 years on the climate situation is the state and the elites, to be more precise, are terrified that it's going to get out there. It's like a scandal, you know, it's like, it's a big cover-up. And the thing that's going to make people talk about it is the public political conflict of people being prosecuted, arrested, going to prison, you know. And they know that. So every time that we challenge them, they just retreat.
Martin, it sounds almost marvellous if you can make that happen. Are they going to retreat each time?
I think what's interesting about them, if you look at the background of Extinction Rebellion, is they've got contacts to Canvas, which is based in Serbia, which is based on Otpor, and these are all what you might call colour change organisations related to the National Endowment for Democracy, which is the US, basically US intelligence.
That's George Soros.
Yes. Well, it's not George Soros works with them.
He's very close to that lot. Yeah, so you're saying it's some sort of conspiracy?
Well, no, what I would say is I'm very happy to see young people go out and challenge the state. Whatever happens, they're going to learn a lot from it, and it's always good. But I think that we've got to have a proper debate about how all this stuff works, and what manipulations are going on behind the scenes.
Estella, what would you like to see change out of all of this? Because this is one of the things XR haven't been all that clear about exactly what they want to see change. Mm. They're very clear about the problem and not so clear about the solutions. Mm. Have you got any thoughts about those?
Well, I mean, obviously air quality is a major issue in Bristol, as we probably know. I mean, Bristol is ostensibly an environmentally conscious city, yet we have one of the worst air quality pollution problems in the country. So that seems to be an urgent issue, which we are trying to deal with at the level of city council. But obviously it needs people to change their behaviour as well. And one of the issues for climate change is the extent to which we are all invested in not changing our behaviour. That's the trouble, you know. And as long as we don't have decent public transport without investing in things like that, as long as we're encouraged to go on holidays, on aeroplanes, then it's very difficult to change.
Let me put my two papers in there, because most of the aircraft journeys are business journeys, not holidays.
Yeah.
So I think in a way it's almost like blaming the kids for leaving the light on. You know, going on a plane to Marbella once a year isn't actually what's the major cause
that's
of
true.
The problem. The business travellers should be using Skype, and that means, of course, your friends at the NSA can listen to everything they say, Kevin, and maybe that's why some of the people do go on, because they want confidential conversations. The other thing is absolutely brilliant on public transport, because this is I think what we need to do here in Bristol too, is to make public transport free. Am I allowed to say that? Because this is one of the things that I picked up, and there were some people discussing this, and I got onto Twitter and started doing the same, was back in 1981, Ken Livingstone, Martin Summers, was elected to make public transport free in London, and he very nearly managed to do it, but he was sabotaged by Bromley's Conservative Council, and they said through the High Court and through the Law Lords that he wasn't actually allowed to do what he'd said he'd do in his manifesto. So they said, no, you can't make public transport free, and hence we've got things like congestion charge. We've got loads of air pollution here in cities like Bristol and London.
Well, that's right, and it makes me wonder when these people go on about Brexit early, what democracy we ever had in this country, that he was stopped by the law lords from implementing the policy being elected on the ludicrous grounds that he wasn't allowed to subsidise public transport, it had to be make it pay its way. Nobody does that in the whole world, so it was absurd. And then, of course, he carried on. We had the Fares Fair campaign where people were refusing to pay the fares. I was one of them. And then, of course, they abolished the GLC to get rid of him because they knew they couldn't beat him in a democratic election. And when Brexiteers go on about democracy in this country that we're going to lose if we don't get Brexit, I say, what democracy? We've never had
8,000, well, we do, to a certain extent.
Yes, to a certain extent.
Yeah. 8,000 less serious accidents on the road Ken Livingstone managed to achieve in his first year of the Fares Fair policy. And if I get my figures right, this is just from memory, folks, it was 15% more increase in the amount of revenue from the fares, because he hadn't completely got rid of them. He just cut them by a third. But by cutting the fares on the tube and the buses by a third, and the trains, they got more money in.
Yeah,
so
because of the last
system.
It
just seems to be a no-brainer. Yeah. Come on, First Bus, are you listening?
Well, that's the First Bus aren't there to get the public to work. They're there to make money, aren't they?
Well, maybe it's because their margins go down. They have to build. They have to employ more people. They get more. They may get more money in, but the margin is actually a bit less. So the shareholders get less.
Actually, Bristol's one of a few cities where usage of buses has increased over the last year, and it's partly because we have a very youthful population, I think. And First Bus have actually attempted to do some work with the city council to do things like decrease fares, and we've got the metro bus. Flawed though it is at least some, you know.
Okay, so they decreased some fares, but then they increased others, didn't they? To make it all a little bit perverse. Anyway, Kevin, what about you? You've seen this over the years, people trying to make public transport worth using, and they seem to be failing, don't they?
The example you've just given of where you drop the fares. You get an increase in people using the systems and less people using their cars.
Less kids getting run over, for example.
Well, of course.
We can't do that in Bristol, though, until we have a proper system of transport control, which we don't have.
Franchising. Come on, Tim Bowles. I have to put another email out to Tim or phone him up and say, come on, Tim, explain to us, please, Mr. Metro Mayor, Conservative, why you don't want to have bus franchising. It's a bit of a no-brainer, isn't it?
It is a no-brainer, absolutely, yeah.
Why?
Well, because public transport, as for reasons we've been giving, benefits the city more generally, but it has to be properly structured. And at the moment in Bristol, we've got some okay bus routes, but we've got a very fragmented public transport system. Now, ideally, we'd invest regionally in an effective, joined-up public transport system which involves trams, buses, trains, you know, a proper strategic transport plan for me. That isn't going to happen as long as we've got a Tory government in power, because they have no interest in doing that.
And Metro Mayor, come on, Tim.
And a Tory Metro Mayor.
Get your finger out, mate. Now, because I invoked the 1980s there, I thought, why don't we have a listen to the former Bank of England Governor Mervyn King talk about the difference between his generation and the present generation, because I think for a lot of young people now, they just don't realise that the Mervyn King's generation, born in the 1950s, had a much, much easier life than young people do today without being saddled with debt. In fact, managing to buy a private home, that sort of thing, much more easily. So let's have a listen to, and this is a talk he did about his book about 2 or 3 months ago, but I found it absolutely fascinating. He says, I'm from the luckiest generation ever.
I've always said I belong to the luckiest generation of all, that is born in 1948. I was young enough not to have to fight in the Second World War, as my father did, and young enough not to even to do national service, but I was old enough not to have to pay a penny for my education. When I was an undergraduate at university, there were no loans. I even got paid a maintenance grant to pay for my housing and drinks in the evening and so on. Very generous of my parents' generation to pay for that. Obviously, that's all gone. And I was also very fortunate to have bought a house at a time when I thought, house prices have gone up quite a bit, so I better buy a house, but way before the big house price rises that happened afterwards. And the younger generation are stuck with paying for education, borrowing to finance that, and borrowing a vast amount to buy a very tiny apartment or house. Now, in the long run, this will work out, but the big threat, I think, to the younger generation now, and this is why I think concerns are really justified, let's suppose interest rates start to rise. Not now, But in 15, 20 years, just before, you know, you start to sell your house, well, house prices could come right back down again. And the younger generation will have been bought at the peak and have to sell them at the trough. And the other problem, of course, which is a really serious issue now, is that the pension scheme, which is offered to younger people, is so much less attractive than the one that I was offered. Why? Because the interest rate which can be earned on the savings that go in to provide the pension, whether it be your savings directly as a a defined contribution pension scheme, or whether it be the savings which your employer puts to one side through a defined benefit scheme, the return on those schemes are very low. And the obverse of, you know, high rates putting up asset prices is that as interest rates fall to where they are now, close to zero, the cost of providing a pension in the future is much higher. There is no incentive to save. And these are very big problems, which is why I think it's very important that we get back to a normal level of interest rates sooner rather than later.
I almost feel that's a pitch for taking over for Mark Carney, Kevin. He's just about to be replaced. And I could not believe the Treasury have found some sort of city headhunting firm to go and find a new boss for the Bank of England, apparently. But anyway, what do you make of what he's saying there? He's really saying, effectively, it's like boiling frogs. Over the years, slowly but surely, the deal has got worse and worse and worse. And now young people are over a barrel.
Indeed. I mean, what he said, I didn't have to pay for my university education. I had all the benefits he had. Plus, we bought our house when it was possible for young people to buy a house. Nobody seemed to notice that Margaret Thatcher, for all she was supposed to have done, halted the property-owning democracy. And, you know, the Tories...
She made council houses for sale. Surely she was increasing the property-owning public.
It didn't work out like that, because she left the kind of people who would need a council house. The money that came in wasn't used to replace the houses that were being sold. It was almost just an accounting exercise. It did not benefit the population in general.
Well, it massively boosted the whole buy-to-let world. Martin, why is it we're in this situation now for young people? They're getting such a ridiculously raw deal to people like Mervyn King.
Well, if you read Thomas Piketty's book, Capital in the 21st Century, and so on, there are big, long cycles in the way that capitalism works. And the zero interest rates, I mean, after the Brexit vote, you were saying earlier that the economy didn't collapse. That's because Mark Carney put a great big slop of quantitative easing in the system, which kept the whole asset bubble going. I mean, this country lives on the never-never.
It's not just this country, is it?
No, it's everybody.
It's the Eurozone
is completely messed up as well.
Do you understand why young people are really angry and actually do want to get out on the streets and do something?
Yes, I certainly can. And, the state is quite strong and people get exhausted. In every generation, there are people come forward to, prepared to have a go. And then, of course, they get disillusioned and tired because it's just a big uphill fight.
Estella, some of your students might even call it a stitch-up.
They might. I mean, I think Mervyn King is right to some extent, but he's describing an experience which is actually quite partial, which is actually primarily very middle class. So my parents didn't go to university. I grew up in a council house. And actually, my parents got their foot on the property ladder by buying their council house. Now, I'm not defending Thatcherite's policies subsequently, because the main problem was, as Kevin's pointed out, that there was no further investment in council housing. And we're now in a situation in Bristol where we have a massive shortage of decent social housing, an inflated bubble of private housing, and young people especially struggling to get any kind of decent accommodation. But we've also had a massive expansion of students. And one of the issues, actually, which we don't really talk about very much, is there's an unregulated market in students in Bristol, and that is placing enormous pressures on the available housing stock. So just to put in a word for my administration, our top priority, as you know, was to build houses, and that will start to change some of that. But of course, at the end of the day, what we need is a commitment from national government. So the kind of housing bubble we've described, in which it's almost impossible to get a mortgage, mainly because you don't have the savings, that's one of the things that can only really be dealt with by national fiscal policy and national housing policy.
Well, it's a rentier economy, and a lot of this is about land, which brings me to half of England is owned by less than 1% of the population. This is in The Guardian. Research by author Guy Shrubsole reveals corporations and aristocrats are the biggest landowners. Well, in a way, Kevin, this is a bit of a reworking of your book, Who Owns Britain, from 19 years ago. I know you've seen the book. I've had a look at it too. What do you make of the new research?
It's a very useful advance, but without criticising Guy, we need a much tougher one than he's come through with. The entire population of the United Kingdom occupy less than 5.4% of the land. That's something like 50 million of us in a tiny, effectively, on a tiny piece of land.
So you're saying 94% of Britain is empty?
No, it's not empty.
What's it got on it?
It's owned by companies. About a third of it is still owned by the aristocracy and their cousins. I feel Guy didn't look closely enough into what are called the cousinhoods.
Well, now's your chance. What would you say should be maybe the missing chapter from the book? What should we be doing in our national policy to do with land in order to free this land up and in order to help people like Estella and various people at the City Council to be building houses, basically affordable houses, maybe council homes, that sort of thing, that don't cost, like, whatever it is, £1,000 a month to rent.
Yeah. And Guy has it, and he does spot it, and it's very important. When you're going to do these things, the first thing you need are facts. And he focuses in on the land registry. This is 2019, and the land registry belongs to 1919. They haven't got a list of landowners. And listen to the excuse. They don't have a list of landowners because there is only one landowner, the Crown. Everybody else. But then when you press them and say, so what do we have? I'm thinking perhaps of freeholders. We've actually got leases. So none of us.
Hang on. You're really confusing me now. Freeholders have got leases.
They're actually...
Estella's parents who bought their council house, they're not actually freeholders. They're leaseholders. What do you mean?
A freehold is a leasehold. That's how it's defined in the Land Registration Act 2001. A freehold is a lease.
From?
The Crown.
Well, yes, but the Queen is not going to come and take your house off. I don't think she
Young is. Tony, that's a... You shouldn't say things like that. She has an army of, civil servants and others. And you should see the ferocity with which the Canadian civil services enforces the Crown's ultimate ownership.
Let's be frank. This is a nominal thing. Freeholders are not going to get their house. They're not going to get the household cavalry turn up, or the guards outside their door and saying, get out of here, the Queen is requisitioning your home, are they?
No, that's still not the point. By keeping it, one step removed from ownership, there's always a potential threat there. You should either own the house or not.
Okay, so look, the main problem here is not necessarily the Queen, although I understand that there may be some legal niceties to sort out with her, but it's the redistribution of this land. So that people have got somewhere that they can... of course, we all know as well that having somewhere permanently as a freehold in many ways is better than leasing, because if you're renting or leasing, first of all, you can be evicted easily, number one, and secondly, you don't put as much time and effort into something if it's not yours. Yeah. You look at the gardens, for example, in a street which is all rented accommodation, you'll find they're not really looked after in the same way as people who manicure their lawns who own their own place. So it's much better to have, surely, to actually have that security of tenure. And people just don't have it. How do we get that back?
Well, one way, and it would in theory cost nothing, is to cancel the Crown's position so that people, when they had a freehold, would have ownership. And then you could tackle the issue of leases and get rid of those.
Well, you're saying converting leaseholds into, or renting accommodation into permanent ownership?
Yeah. This is, having looked, but nothing
you
changes.
They did that in Ireland, didn't they? Back in the 1800s, I seem to remember.
No, but sort of. It was,
well, they did, yeah. I mean, there was
the land.
The Parnell and the land. And yeah. In fact, what it was a weird situation, rather similar to today, funnily enough, with the Irish MPs holding the balance of power in Westminster, that rather twisted the arm of the Conservative Party up behind their back, and they said either you pass these acts to transfer ownership to the tenants in Ireland.
That's
this
right.
is after the famine, of course, and there was a lot of feeling, very strong feeling in Ireland about this. So maybe something similar here? Is that feasible?
It's needed. But like I said, the first thing you need are hard facts, and to get the hard facts, you need a land registry that's modern and up to date, where there would be no confusion about how many freeholders there are, how many leaseholders, and so on.
Estella, is this pie in the sky, trying to make sure everyone has got security of tenure?
No, I think everyone should have security of tenure. But again, it takes national legislation. I mean, there's two separate issues here, aren't there? One is about the ownership of land, and the other is the administration of actually households in terms of things like land, you know, landlords and tenants and so forth. That's kind of two separate concerns. But I really do think we need to strengthen the regulations around landlords who can exploit their tenants, who can effectively, you know, chuck them out after a relatively short period of time. And as you rightly said, it leads to increasing insecurity, uncertainty. That has massive impact, actually, on the social fabric. If people are being moved around a city or a country all the time, the kids can't get stability at school, all of that has a massive impact on things like mental health issues, physical health. But that's a slightly separate issue to the question of who owns land, which is a very, very big question. And I would say about that, but one of the things that most people don't recognise is the extent to which an awful lot of land in this country is owned by big organisations and institutions, like the MOD, for example. It owns enormous tracts of land.
Forestry Commission, the Church.
Forestry Commission, the Church of England, massive land owners.
Surely the real big ones are the Duke of Buccleuch and Westminster, aren't they?
The Church of England owns about 100,000 acres, peanuts.
Okay.
And that's, again, because there's no proper land registry that you can go to and say, Church of England, give me the list.
Mm.
That's one of the really critical things. The other thing is that if you believe in democracy, the only way to give people a stake is to give them a bit of land. It worked in Ireland till the financial crisis,
well,
but they've come out of it.
Just a minute, but I mean, you're talking about the plantations, because these were given to soldiers who'd fought in Ireland, weren't they?
That was 400 years ago.
That's traditionally has been a way that people do get land, isn't it? You fight for the land for us, and then we'll give you some of it.
Well, some of somebody else's, the losers.
Yeah.
But the transfer, the Irish themselves have never properly understood the extent to which the change of ownership from, you know, landlords to mostly peasant farmers actually worked. It made Ireland what it is today, and it's relatively prosperous.
Okay, well, the book is
Who Owns England? And it's Guy Shrubsole.
Okay, and I'll put a link up to the book on our show page. And also, I should put a link up to your book as well, because yours is a bit more expanded, isn't it? First you expand to Britain, and then you expand to the world. Who owns the world?
Oh, good question.
That's about the most ambitious book project I've heard of in my entire life.
Well, why not?
And you're doing Who Owns Ireland too, I think, aren't you?
Who Owns Ireland is finally due in a couple of months' time.
Okay.
But don't wait for me to be nice to the landlords. I think they were scumbags.
Okay, so that's time for BCFM the news. US-owned Comcast News at 7. Thanks to our guests, Labour Councillor for Lockleys, Estella Ticknell. Join us after the news as we spread our wings.